Hi, my name is Richard Dennis Bartlett. I'm sitting here in my house in Castiglioncello in Italy. You're listening to The Local Gossip. It's an experiment in decentralized podcasting. The way I understand the experiment is that anyone who has some contact with the Scuttlebutt community is welcome to contribute something. For my contribution, I wanted to increase the accessibility of the podcast, so I collected all the existing episodes and put them into what's known as an RSS feed. That means you can listen to it on any podcasting app. And when I published this new access point for the podcast, my friend Naomi Joy Smith replied saying, I've had an interview with Dominic Tarr, who is the founder of Scuttlebutt. And she asked if it was okay to publish the interview here, and I said, yes, of course. So here it is, the latest episode of The Local Gossip with Naomi and Dominic. Have fun listening to some sweet New Zealanders having a conversation about how to be a great guest, about the dream economy, and not paying rent.
Good. You're recording.
Great, yeah. I can hear us. Do you want to check the headphones off?
I think the level should be good. So these mics are... So you want to...
Hello.
Yeah, I mean, if you have an audio... Like any audio engineer can get that out, I think. So you want to stay about 10 centimeters away from the mic.
Like here?
Closer.
This is good?
Yeah, closer. Like
roughly this. That's at a different decibel. Gotta be suave with that one. Once we're already recording, so we'll just
the first time I ever gave a presentation in front of like more than 30 people was in a conference in Berlin called RejectJS. It was for all the people that had applied to this JavaScript conference and they didn't get to talk. They can talk on this day. And I spoke at this in front of 100 people.
Wow.
Well, I don't know. It was like at least 100 people. And I was drinking a club mate for like the first time. And I worked a couple of jokes and I did one joke and like maybe a third of the people laughed. I did one joke. One person, my friend subs, he was the only one who got the joke, but like one person laughing, that's actually an achievement. But zero people laughing, that's really sad.
Yeah,
one person
right.
laughs, you're like, yeah, that was awesome, but only that guy noticed.
That's almost better than a round of applause,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. But then from the club mate, I burped. I did this massive burp and I was like, bleh, and I was like mic'd up with like a mic like this.
Okay,
and
on your face.
Everybody laughed. It was like, I was like, first I was just like a bit shocked, but I was like, okay, that was awesome. And then just like keep on going. But then eventually when they put the talk, the video up, they edited it out.
Without consulting you.
And I was like, why did you do that? That was the funniest bit.
Exactly.
I was like,
how did they not know that was the whole point of your speech? That could have been a metaphor.
Yeah, it's because I was going to like, I wanted to like collect this like clip reel of tech talks, segments from tech talks that were good enough to be stand up. And I was just going to like splice in this burp. Then everyone laughs at the and like somewhere in the middle of that. And it's like, they didn't, I was like, why do you still have the footage? Can you put it back in or can you give it to me or something like this? And it's not the first time I've actually had this because, like, Kiwis have, like, self-deprecating humor.
Classic.
And, like, other people don't realize we're being funny.
Yeah, also, the tone of our voice when we practice sarcasm is not anything to go by.
Yeah.
Like, what I just said wasn't sarcastic, and from an outsider's point of view, probably they would assume it was. Yeah.
But, like, happens. I mean, that's the whole...
This is a premise to me for why not to over-engineer anything. Mm-hmm. And it takes me back to the idea of galumphing.
Galumphing.
Just to reiterate that
a
word
very
into your
valuable,
database.
Oh, I think for listeners, you should probably explain the...
I don't think we've quite begun. But perhaps,
oh, we haven't begun recording?
Have we?
Yeah,
I would like to
well,
introduce
you. Well,
you
said we did have done recording.
Yeah, sure, the recording's on.
But that was like the trailer. And do now we can, okay.
Do you listen to the On Being podcast? They do the unedited and the edited version. And, you know, if I really could get funded to dedicate
the
myself
edited
to one
version
thing
is for
this,
boring people. Like, the unedited.
Sometimes when you're on a go in a pinch, it does tell a beautiful story.
Well, I think, okay, you can introduce me if you like, and then I would like to talk about galumphing.
Fantastic. Yeah. Okay, so to the audience at home, who I'm presuming are a handful of people who have some stake in learning about Dominic Tarr and the work that you do, and also perhaps even myself, Naomi Joy Smith. I could just say that on the off chance that this goes into unknown territory beyond
if
my control.
There aren't people that are interested in learning about Naomi Joy Smith, I think they should be.
I would hesitate to have a dictatorial approach over my
Well, I can
persona.
Say that.
Thank you. Yeah. I'll take the flattery and and keep the control mechanisms at bay. So this is a series of podcasts, and a lot of people now tonight have asked me, so do you run a podcast? And without your input on the matter, I have tended to respond, I would really like to create podcasts as a means of getting to know people who I want to collaborate with. And that's a, what was the word that you taught me before?
Runcible.
That's a Runcible podcast. So in this case, we get to have a chat. Mm-hmm. We get to create an artifact for all of humankind and maybe share this around our networks if we start doing work together, and then can create a more person-to-person approach toward collaboration.
Can I give you some free advice?
I will accept.
Don't say, just say, of course I have a podcast.
Of course.
Yeah.
Do you not know who I am? Yes, but then that builds a kind of an expectation, which I feel I get this anxiety trigger.
You haven't
that.
Fully decided if you want to have a podcast or not?
I have a lot of projects already. I mean, I still have to tell you about my 8-zone system project design map.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you do. Yeah.
Sorry, but I could argue anything that I do could be
I'm
supporting
sure
any
you
one of those
could
projects.
Deny having. You could just be like later, like you don't have to get married to podcasts. You could later be like, I'm post-podcast.
I flirted with podcasts. It could be.
Yeah.
But did you know that when I was, and you don't know this, so I'm not sure why I'm asking, did you know? Did you know that when I was about 10 years old, I would record, like, I don't think we had Channel Z back, like, that late, but I don't know, ZM and The Edge and stuff like this, and all my favorite pop songs would come on, and then record them onto cassette tape, and then record myself.
Just like a radio DJ.
Doing the radio hosting. Yeah. And stacking up playlists. And I had friends over and I'd interview them. So I think there has been a kind of life stream that has led us to this moment.
Yeah.
Don't call me too woo.
No, I also did that at one time.
Did you? Really?
Yes. At least one time with me and my little brother was like co-DJ, and we just like made a radio show on a cassette tape. I can't remember
so
ever
exciting.
Listening to it again. I can't remember if we had music. We just might have.
Oh. Yeah, talk back.
Yeah, it was just talk radio. Like 5-year-old. I'm sure it was very entertaining. Maybe the tape's still out there somewhere.
It was probably better than most podcasts are today. I would stake some gin on that.
Hmm.
Okay, and before we get to jargon, I'd also like to create a bit of context for this interview. Uh-huh. Today we find ourselves using the studio at Full Node in Berlin, just for the government spies out there who'd like to track our recordings. There's a party in the background which you can sort of pick up on in the pre-production of this audio. And this party comes during Blockchain Week. We've just met at the end of DAO Fest and started to meet some common interest folk. But Dominic and I met a few weeks ago now at the Borderland Festival and ended up having some fantastic conversations in Surinam, which led to the conception of recording something together. And now here we are.
Mm-hmm.
And the joke that I just told, I'm not going to unpack, even though I set all of this up just so that I could unpack that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm deciding right now to be a bit of a provocateur.
Stay mysterious.
Yeah, definitely. Like, if you want to know the lexicon, this is a good excuse to reach out to me and create a human system out of this podcast. I don't really want to over-engineer and make it too easy for anybody. We are in the world of games. So, Dominic, would you like to play with me? Right here, right now.
Well, here I am.
In a conversational space. All right. I'll take that as consent. Thank you for being upfront about it.
So what about galumphing then?
So galumphing is a term that, if I was really as detailed as you tend to be, I could probably trace the author who came up with this concept. But
that was my first question. What is the etymology of galumphing?
Fantastic. I thought you'd never ask, and now I will boot my laptop so that I can really give you a deep dive into the galumph.
Can I guess?
Yeah, please do.
I've got a funny feeling that now that I stop to think about it, galumphing is something that Eeyore does from Christopher Robin in The Hundred Acre Wood.
How positive are you on that? Is that like a
trivial pursuit? It's like a funny feeling.
Is that like a pub quiz kind of?
It's like a funny feeling that I'm becoming increasingly more sure of. So I would like this to be fact checked.
If I'd learned about that, I think I could trace A.A. Milne through my history database. And that's not where I came across it. But it does say that galumph first lumbered onto the English scene in 1872 when Lewis Carroll used the word to describe the actions of the vanquisher of the Jabberwock in Through the Looking Glass.
Right, yep.
Wow, fantastic.
That's good too. That's even better, maybe.
Sure. I first heard the word and I instantly thought about an elephant galumphing, so I'm not sure where that connotation comes from. The dictionary definition here says to move with a clumsy, heavy tread, but that's certainly not where I picked it up and started using it. I gave you a different definition earlier, and so I think it would be kind of beautiful if I could find the quote that contextualized for me that galumphing actually indicates a higher intelligence of a being, because rather than being focused on their survival, there is the intelligence to enjoy the present moment, such as your well-renowned...
They have curiosity.
They have curiosity, sure. Leaving space for the unknown. So enlightenment, as I've witnessed in you tonight. Hope that's not too high of a bar to set. I see you squinting.
Oh, I'm waiting for you, whatever you're doing.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I'm going to find it in a quote, because what would I look up?
We can edit this bit out later.
Yeah. It's not really going anywhere. I think we're glumping our way to some utilitarian podcast material. What would be the vital end goal of this podcast? What would you like to see come out of it?
I don't really think about end goals that often. I mean, sometimes I do, but then other times I'm just, I just go wherever I'm needed.
Sure, okay.
I don't have a plan. I don't look at the guidebook. Just like, whoever I bump into, that's the people I should have bumped into.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been treating... I think since Borderland, I really crossed the point where I do that by default now. I have a history of social anxiety. And for a long time, there was this self-reflection around, okay, did I do what I needed to do? Did I make the most out of that moment? And since, for some years I've been building up to it, but now it's switched and become my default that I just assume if I'm meeting somebody that there's a good reason for it. On the bus, I spent 2 days on a bus to get him. I was running late for my second bus from Copenhagen and literally running with a heavy bag. And then I saw another woman heading in the same direction looking kind of confused. And I asked if she was going to Berlin. She said yes. And, you know, I don't initiate conversation with strangers very often. But this catalyzed a friendship where we then found ourselves on a bus full of Romanian people who were traveling from Norway to Romania on the bus.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's... If you were doing 2 days, they must have been going like another 3 days.
I can't imagine. It's it didn't make any sense to me as a business model until we saw them come into a petrol station, slow down, hand a bag out of the window to someone, and then leave.
Ah, yeah. Well, that's how business gets done these days.
Right. Door to door.
Yeah.
It's like the lieferando.
It's all about, it's a matter of quality of service and personal connections.
Personal connections, okay. And something about the Romanian travelers. I mean, it was a very strange environment to find ourselves. And I didn't question, what should I say to this woman? Should I reveal much about myself? I just fully laid bare in front of her, metaphorically and well, not so literally. in this case. But we clicked, and we didn't have a lot of shared language or context. However, I just felt, okay, we've discovered each other here and now. Whatever I say, however open I can be, is going to give some... I'm going to plant some seeds. So let's see where that goes. Yeah, I don't find the quote about glumping. So shall we steer the ship somewhere? I feel like... maybe this entire preamble is cuttable. But it's beautiful. Hear that we finally fourth wall? Got ourselves.
There's going to be a mysterious forbidden bit that you're not going to see.
Exactly. You don't even know that this moment exists. And that is a glump.
It's a glitch in the matrix.
Boom.
Yeah. I think the Matrix was actually a very interesting time and space, because like when I was like a teenager when the Matrix came out, but I was like quite a precocious teenager, and by the time like I just recently read Descartes' book, and he's like mentioning that what if he's just like the whole world is just a demon is creating this impression of this in front of him, and then the Matrix comes out and I'm like, I just read the book of this, like
seen it,
yeah, like whatever. And it was like written like 300 years ago and
yeah,
something like that, and my friend was like, whoa, it's so trippy, and I was like, yeah, well, this Descartes already like describes this, and then all of West mod like science and
yeah,
but the Matrix like was like a popular movie where it's like,
well, it's great for the mass to reference an archetypal journey that we all experience from time to
like
time.
Now that understanding the idea that all of reality could just be illusion, it's just like an obvious idea. It's like, oh, it's just that Matrix movie.
Yes,
like you know, like actually, like 100 years ago or something, there was like the theory of relativity, and people would say like, oh, but only like 3 people understand it in the world and stuff like this. And one of those people was Einstein.
Is that what the haters were saying?
Well, yeah, exactly. I guess so. But then one of those 3 people was guy Gödel, who was this mathematician who he figured out this kinds of interesting. So he was a good friend of Einstein. In fact, Einstein, they were both Jewish, and World War II was like starting or is building up or something. And Einstein was like, Gödel, you've got to get the fuck out of Europe, come to America right now, because it's going to be really bad. And he got them in. But Gödel was really like, I have looked at the Constitution, and I have come up with a logical proof that America could elect a dictator, and so it's not perfect. And then he thought that the immigration hearing, where they were deciding whether or not to let him into a country, was a good place to inform the like judge about this problem with the Constitution. And Einstein was like, just. This talk, we can tell everyone about this later.
Exactly. Just choose like, your
don't
moment.
Don't mention this now. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just an anecdote to explain what Gödel was like. But the really lasting impact on society he had. Here's a proof that mathematics was either consistent. With these, that was either inconsistent or incomplete. You can research that for yourself, listeners. But He also poked holes in Einstein's theory of relativity, and he was the one who came up with the twins paradox, which was that, like, if you traveled off at the speed of light, you would come back and you would be massively older than your twin.
Yeah.
And he basically figured out all of these. He was like, what happens if he was the first one to be like, what happens if you go back and kill your grandfather and stuff like this? Like, okay, all these problems with time travel.
It's like metaphysics.
Yeah. Yes, but it was like inspired by relativity. Wow. And he was like basically coming up with all these logical problems with time travel, which then later became made into a great movie, Back to the Future.
Sure.
And now the idea of time travel and the problems with it are just obvious to children.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the power of narrative.
Yeah.
And it makes a lot of sense to speak in archetype in this sort of way. I mean, to me, an archetype is like when you try to preserve the fruit. You're not eating it fresh. Mm-hmm. You might need to do something in order to get it back to an edible, enjoyable quality.
It's but a jam. It is
like a jam.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think of it more in terms of freeze-dried army food.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. Like, you got to add some hot water. That water's got to be heated up. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to do things in the present moment in order to unpack what is within that story. Mm-hmm. But, of course, we evolved around narrative. So it's powerful
to
rehash that sort of thing.
Yep.
We were going somewhere earlier with this pattern language.
Well, then we started galumphing.
Yeah. I don't think that the galumphing really began in this moment. I feel like it's maybe the silence that underpins all the other conversation. I think the topic was your enlightenment.
Well, I mean, the adept, the novice sees mountains and they're not mountains, and then the journeyman sees like that everything is the same, and then the master is like can see the mountains and the non-mountains
at the same time.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's like the reclaimed innocent at the end of the hero's journey. I think it's like
there is no enlightenment.
Yeah, okay.
But realizing that the mystery is there's actually just nothing.
Sure.
There isn't like some magical answer that explains everything.
No, and that's a meme that I have been reiterating around blockchain people in the last few days, which is, what makes you think that there is a solution to solve, like, mm-hmm. this one problem that's in the way, rather than designing to allow for that permanent tension mm-hmm. and have conversations about how that tension's going, keeping up with it. Yeah. I also just really wanted to see what would happen to directly refer to you as enlightened, because I'm curious if there's an observer effect into this. And I noticed just earlier that you called me a shaman mm-hmm. and trying to observe what happened to me in that moment, which was, first, what do I know about shamanism outside of indigenous cultures? Mm-hmm. And that is that one cannot self-refer as shaman, but would only by their community be observed as one. Mm-hmm. And that made me think, cool, I hope we're in a community.
Basically, it's like a crazy person that lives on the fringes of society and therefore has a perspective that other like non-fringe dwelling people don't have.
Mm.
And so occasionally the air quotes shaman, you know, when the townsfolk are like, village folk are like, shit, everything has gone wrong. What do we do? Let's go ask that crazy person who lives in the woods. They might have an idea. And then they go and like, oh, you should probably do this or something like that. And then they just go and try that thing. And
so it's like a consultant who doesn't have so much bias or investment in the original system, and you can just come and introduce seeds of new, fresh perspective.
Yeah, I don't like the word consultant.
In this context or at all?
I probably would lean towards at all.
Yeah.
They're definitely someone who gets consulted, but like,
yeah, but there are traditions,
yes,
of shamanism,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah, you need to receive a training from more senior shaman, but you'll just stumble upon people like this who are like giving you, who like just crazy wise people, crazy slash wise people, because often they're sort of and then they'll say things to you. Like one shaman that trained me a bit, I was like, I've been sailing around, I'd built this canoe, and I was sailing in sailing around the Hauraki Gulf in New Zealand and sleeping on beaches and stuff like this, and I got into Waiheke, and people were like, "That's pretty good. You're doing pretty good." But I'd be impressed if you made it to Barrier. Mm-hmm. So I was like, "Oh, okay. What's this Barrier place?" And I didn't really know anything about it, except that it had
Great Barrier Reef.
Great Barrier Island.
Right.
Yeah, it is like Waiheke Island is basically a suburb of Auckland. Yeah. It's like pretty, but it's like you can catch a ferry there in like half an hour from central Auckland. Great Barrier, the ferry takes 4 hours. That means you can't commute from Great Barrier Island. If you're living on Great Barrier Island, you're living there.
Yeah.
And so it's like one of those places where it's like the end of the road, and then you go there when you want to get away from everything. Like New Zealand itself is actually like the best thing, and the worst thing about it is that it's
the fringe of the fringe.
The like there's no other place that's easier to get to once you're in New Zealand except for Antarctica. It has the world's, except for Antarctica, the world's greatest moat.
So you're saying New Zealand is easier to get to than Antarctica?
Yes,
but nowhere else.
Yeah. And anyway, so then you can, once you're in New Zealand, you can go to the end of the road in New Zealand.
Yeah, you can go to Stewart Island.
Yes.
No,
yeah, Stewart Island is like even more remote than Great Barrier. But in Great Barrier Island, everyone just lives spread out. Anyway, I was on the beach on Great Barrier Island, and I had just, I was just eating like a can of spaghetti on the, by my boat. And I was just going to throw this in the rubbish bin. And then I walk past, and there's this like strange old man with like long gray hair and a beard. Like imagine me plus 40 years. Maybe 30 years. I don't think he was 70. He was like 60 or something. And he was like, "Howdy, traveler." And he put his hand out, and I shook his hand, and I was like, he's like, "They call me the wizard." And I'm like, "Okay." And he's like, "I can see you're a traveler. What were you just about to do?" And I was like, I was just going to like throw this can away. And then I was actually going to go to sleep under one of those dinghies. And he was like, "Oh, I'm impressed, but I've got an even better idea. Would you like a drink?" And I'm like, you know, my policy in this sort of situation is to accept. So I'm like, "Of course." And he's like, "Have a seat." And he motions to this park bench as if it's like a seat inside of his house. And I'm like, "Okay, I'll sit down." And then he brings out this bright green soft drink in this like bottle that's like the Carnival like soft drink things. It's like you buy like a
crate. For kids' birthday parties.
Yeah, you buy, get like 12 of them in a thing, and it's like all different really bright colors. It's like just like a cheap fizzy drink. And I'm like, "Oh, this is a strange thing for a crazy old man to be drinking." And I taste it, and it's like clearly alcoholic. And I was like, "Okay, this is starting to make more sense."
Yes.
And then I tell him about my boat and this sort of stuff, and he explains that he got the name the Wizard because he lived on top of a mountain on Great Barrier Island, and the local, some people would come and visit him, walk an hour through the bush to get to his house drink his home brew and stuff like this, and they named him the Wizard because of his interest in the occult.
Okay, I follow.
And then he assured me he wasn't homosexual, and then invited me back to his place where he had more drinks and music. And I was like, how could I turn down an offer like that, especially since I've been assured that you're not just trying to have sex with me. And I'm like, great. I was like, okay, cool, let's go. And then hung out with him for like 3 days, and multiple times after that came back and visited him. But he gave me some really valuable life lessons. And one was, one was how to be a good traveler and a good guest. Because he was half Kiwi, half Samoan.
Mm-hmm.
And
Kiwi, like Pākehā.
Yeah, but he had come to New Zealand like in when he was like a small child, but he still had some memory from growing up in the island and when he was like it was like a small child, and he said that back then the travelers were the ones that carried all of the news. So you would go around the travel switch. So
yes.
The you always had to be welcoming to the travelers because that was the only way you found out about what distant family was happening with the distant members of like your distant relatives. Okay.
Yes.
And so you were always you definitely welcomed them. So when you were traveling, you were just like you didn't have to worry about it. You were when you arrived someplace, you would be fed, you would be housed and that sort of stuff.
Mm.
But it was the traveler's job to notice when they were beginning to stay too long. So you had to notice when does the hospitality become slightly more restrained?
Yes.
When does it become a little bit more of like an obligation rather than that eagerly doing it?
Right.
And then when you get to that point, what you do is you give them a gift.
Yep.
And then you depart.
Fantastic.
And then you'll be welcome again.
So that's a training in empathy.
Yeah. And I was hanging out with them like 3 days and I noticed, it's become a little bit strained.
And at this point, had he introduced the concept to you?
Well, he had talked about this on like the first day when we were just drinking, having fun.
Oh.
And I didn't get the feeling that he was like giving me a hint. He was just talking about stuff.
It came up in conversation.
Yeah. We were talking about everything, but he explained the story. Then I realized, hang on, this is what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what kind? I don't know what, like, I didn't really have any kind of gift.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what can I possibly give him? And what I actually did is I made, I had been recently interested in making musical instruments, and I had been like exploring this and reading this book about how to make musical instruments, making different kind of crazy musical instruments.
I think we talked about this at Borderlands.
The book was a really very good book called Musical Instrument Design by Bart Hopkins.
Cool. Definitely I'll put that in the show notes.
Yep. But I had some bits of bamboo and I had some fish skins.
Oh.
Because of this book, I'd been catching fish, and because of this book, I knew that you could make fish skins into drums, and I had just, when I caught the fish, I had skinned the fish very carefully and I just let it dry out, not intending to do anything with it, but I was like, I'll just make a drum. And I made a little drum from this bamboo, and I was like, this is like completely stupid and useless, but I was like, I have made a thing for you. And I gave it to him and he was so happy. He was like, this is in it. And he was like, he got it and he like put it on his mantelpiece, and he had this statue thing that was standing there with its like hands out, and the drum just fit perfectly under it, and it looked like that thing was now playing the drums.
Oh.
And and then I like and I was like, okay, I'm going now, and I like, you know, left, and it was just like that was the perfect
yes
thing.
No more, no less.
Another time, this was actually on the very first time I met him, I was like fixing a thing on my boat. That was my boat's rudder, and I was carving a piece of wood, and I was sitting at his like table, and I was like carving the knife towards me, and he was sitting across, and he was just like, oh, and he just like perked up and just looked really interested in what I was doing. And then I slipped and I cut myself, and he was like, I could see that was going to happen.
Oh, wow.
But he didn't say, oh, don't cut towards yourself, you cut yourself. He was just like, oh. And then I did it. And it's like, now when I do that, I just imagine, I was like, oh, yeah, I imagine him like watching me and eagerly like looking.
Well,
like,
it almost is, as you train in meditation, you develop this capacity of watching yourself as though from the outside. And I feel that to have such a strong story about somebody reacting in such a way, maybe not stopping you, but drawing your attention toward what's going on in that moment, leading to an event.
It was a much better way of teaching me not to draw the knife towards myself.
Yeah.
Than it would have been to just tell me.
Try to control your actions.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So if he just told me not to do that, I'd be like, oh, whatever.
Yeah.
And you'd have to, for someone like that, you have to tell them every single time. If you just laugh at them when they fail, then...
Maybe in New Zealand.
Yeah.
I also try not to laugh at people when they fail. But I wonder if, I mean, what, well,
some
what
people
the
are
outcome
reading,
of
some
that
people,
is
it depends
different.
On how they receive it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, again, the empathy. And the role of the facilitator is to notice in what point of intervention is going to be most useful for that person in particular.
Yeah.
You know, there can be a pattern, and the pattern might be observe the person and hold space for them to lead their own journey.
Yeah.
But the way that turns up in the individual is really case by case. So I wonder if there was also a practice of that. Maybe we can look at how it created such an effect in you, that it was effective as a teaching mechanism, but I don't think that would apply
to yeah, I mean,
every circumstance. And I don't like to be laughed at, personally. It's a personal thing. So I don't do it to other people.
Right.
However, if I found out that it was effective for somebody...
You probably have different lessons that you can teach.
Yeah, I'm sure that I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But as a reincarnation of Jesus, what would you say about love your neighbor as yourself? Like, because I took that in as a child, like, okay, do unto others, you know, as you would do, as you would have them do to you. But we're different people. We can't just assume that somebody wants to be treated the way that you would. And there's an element of holding space for somebody to show up in a different capacity, such as when I learned that eye gazing can be such a deep and profound transformational experience. And I thought, yeah, let's put that into some workshops. And then I was researching autism, and I found out that if someone's on the spectrum, that's a really uncomfortable place to put them into. And so, you know, it's deepening that understanding of contextuality and allowing for each person to lead themselves through a situation. But I think a good teacher gets a playbook of patterns of learning and can notice in the person, let's just see, because they might respond to this in a certain way, and seeks the feedback. And that reminds me of our history of hunting animals, and that we must deeply relate with the animal in order to get to a point that we can choose whether or not it makes sense to take their life.
Or even find it and sneak up on it enough close to that you can
to get
have
a chance.
A good chance. Yeah.
That seems like a natural mechanism.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what you were speaking to earlier about reaching this kind of sense of relaxation into your being.
Oh yes, I was talking about I found a new level of comfort with my introversion.
Yes.
Where previously I would I would feel awkward if I was like in a crowded thing, like a conference, and I didn't immediately have someone to talk to. And I'd just be like, oh, I'm this like weirdo thing that's like talking here. But recently I was basically, I partied so hard at the Borderland that I got to this point where it's like, actually, I'm having too much fun now. I'm just going to dial it back and try to have less fun.
Right.
And then the idea of trying to have less fun was at one level quite funny. So I had this one kind of slow burn joke. And it's like, sometimes the best jokes are like, one particular
a form
type
of, humor.
Of joke
is
you do a really elaborate build up to a very weak punchline. But that it took so long to get to here, and then that's the lame punchline.
It becomes absurd.
That is funny.
Yeah.
Like, that is the funny part, is that that
there's
how
so much
lame
tension that
is.
Wants relief, that it's not about the quality of the joke, but more about the pattern of desiring
like
that relief
that,
somehow.
And that's the and so like I just was just left this one joke. But anyway, then, you know, today I was at this conference thing, and was just like, okay, I'm just gonna try and not talk to people for like 20 minutes, and I just felt completely normal about that. But right now, on the note of of a lame joke with a good setup,
if we could take an interlude.
I remembered one that I was actually planning to tell you.
Oh, fantastic.
So if you would care for a dramatic reading, I have one. that I like to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad that you also could remember what I was talking about when I tried to remember this, because there are some epiphanies I had during DAOFest today that touch on that point. One of being extreme states of joy and what happens when you get to that point, and the other about the story I tell myself about satisfaction. So the satisfaction, I realized I have this narrative that satisfaction comes at the end, and sometimes I push away reaching a point of satisfaction and I seek to self-sabotage or slow down my progress, my conclusion, because I feel that that necessitates the ending, that satisfaction only comes at the end. And I'm now in a place that I could pick that myth apart, because I've experienced moment-to-moment satisfaction and I realize that life does go on from that moment. But that perhaps the drive about goal-seeking in a society where we are now rather privileged, or there's an acceleration of access toward the things that we generations ago could only fathom as possibilities. Maybe there, for certain members of the global society who have access to these acceleration privileges, are becoming more comfortable with satisfaction, in which case we create a new relationship with joy and with feeling such a thing. And after having that series of thoughts within myself, I joined the panel that Kate Beecroft facilitated at the end, where she asked her, was it the final or second to last question that she asked the panelists was, is there a moment that you can recall which gave you internal motivation to do this kind of subversive, very difficult work, you know, work for society?
Yeah.
Right. And then invited the audience to sense into, do we have a story about why we're doing potentially radical work in innovation and society and tech, whatever. And I came to a truth within myself, which was that I've experienced such extreme states of joy, pleasure, and satisfaction from life that I see it as my fundamental duty as a result of that to feed back into creating this kind of a prosperity for others. And that also allowed me to detach from the struggling artist narrative that says only through suffering can one create, can one find this drive. So I think it's not necessary to facilitate further suffering just for the sake of a higher cause.
Yes.
And yet I still can agree with that concept that our sorrow deepens the space for our joy.
I call this idea the dream economy.
Nice.
So the dream economy is sort of like when people that are following a dream, they actually do a hell of a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
They do a huge amount of labor in pursuit of a dream. So once you're operating in the, you know, when you're living in the dream, you're now in the dream economy. But the transactions in the dream economy are inspiring someone. Like if you, it's usually like a one-way thing, because you like, you were inspired by someone and then you inspired them forward.
Yes.
You may not, no, actually being on the giving end of inspiration is actually pretty, is actually pretty great. You can just be like, oh yes, I'm doing good work, continue.
It's worth it for the spark you see in someone's eyes.
And so once you're on that set, you're like, this is just like, this is like, now I'm like gonna keep on doing this, and now you're fully like in the dream economy.
And you can pay rent that way.
You can find a way to live.
I did.
But you're not actually paying rent.
No, but I do practice a karma yogi.
Exactly.
Situation.
Exactly.
Because of the beloved feeling that comes out of this. It's symbiotic.
Yeah. You're occupied. So. You're in the dream economy now.
Yes, I am. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite true of my my default set of interactions in the world, is that I, in terms of the dragon dreaming wheel, and there are the four quadrants, I marginally am dominant in the dreamer. So that's on the axes of internalization and theoretical. And I also have an astrological reading in the tradition of Mayan astrology that affirms me as a yellow harmonic seed. So, or rhythmic, actually, not harmonic, but the seed is planting seeds of inspiration, and not necessarily the person who's yielding the result of that and capitalizing, cashing in on what grows from that seed, but simply ensuring that the potential finds fertile soil at the right time.
Yeah.
That's the rhythmic aspect.
Yes.
Mm. And I, for a long time, have been on a quest to figure out how I can draw my livelihood from doing such a thing. I'm starting to reveal possibilities. And that would be my second answer to the question I referred to earlier from the panel, which was, I think it's a driving sense that I have to do this kind of work also comes from not finding my place in society as it is, feeling that I have to shape the society to fit me rather than shape myself to fit the society, which maybe is a certain character trait, but one that I certainly respect in people, and therefore I think I bias building relationships with other people who shape the world to fit who they are rather than vice versa.
Yeah.
There's a power of no in that.
Yeah.
Mm.
Once upon a time, actually at the end of that boat trip where I met the wizard, I ended up at this intentional community / hippie commune called Wilderland in Coromandel in Whirinanga.
Yeah, the one that had the fire.
Yes.
Yes.
They've had many
setbacks,
things, and ups and downs. Ups, especially ups as well.
Yeah.
And it's actually it's survived since 1969. So it has a lot of, you know, it's
mana.
It's like stuff is important stuff is happening, and like, so since I went there, actually, whenever I've been hitchhiking, like 50% of the people in that general area who pick up hitchhikers have been there, visited there, or involved in there at some point.
Yeah,
like it has actually I think been very successful, and certainly just visiting there was like made when I was like 21 and I realized, oh, it's actually totally different, you know, there's total different ways of living.
So they've got a good traveller kaupapa. They actually they relate to the pollinator, which is something I could talk about with the my project that I'm inviting you into.
Yes.
And for the sake of this podcast, would be cool too.
Yes.
But would you like to finish your story? And maybe we can end on that joke after.
Oh, yeah. So after that, I was just like, well, I could just become hippie, but that would be too easy.
Yes.
I need to move to... I need to give polite society a fair chance. So I went to the city and I got a proper grown-up job where actually, like, I wore a suit when I went and visited clients and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, after, I remember, like, being there on the way to work and stuff like this, and I looked at, in the traffic lights, people, you know, in their suit and tie, sitting behind the wheel of the BMW in the traffic lights, and I thought, if I work really hard, I could become just like them. And
the end is,
I was like, that doesn't look like much fun. And anyway, after
it's a low payoff for a high investment.
Yeah. Yeah. And anyway, after 18 months of being in this job, I was just like, fuck this. Like, I basically came to the conclusion that we were actually like, we were basically scamming the customers. Like, they were the clients were like, because the software was bad, we could charge more, we could bill more hours for like fixing things, and I wanted to just make something that was really good, but
system,
it was
right?
Just like, I was like, I can't be proud of this.
It's called a good business model, Dominic.
Yeah, but I couldn't in good faith recommend this software to anyone.
No,
and I was just like, anyway, after 18 months I was just like, fuck this. If I'm doing any favors for polite society, I'm going to do it on my own terms, not what society wants me to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And after then, my life became a lot more fun. Like, I just, I stopped. I moved into a swamp. I was living in a sailboat in a swamp. And first, I was just like, on the one hand, I just needed to take a break.
Yeah.
Because I felt like I invested a lot into what society thought it wanted me to do, and I was just like, just completely checking out of that. But then people kept on telling me that I was inspiring, and I was like, well, I actually am doing a really good thing just by living in the swamp. And that just encouraged me. I was like, oh, just keep on going. Like, I am contributing to society by not contributing, And
your value is being recognized through the eyes of people whose opinion you are willing to take in.
Yeah, so I just kept on doing that. And now I haven't really paid rent in like 10 years. And it's been lots of fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a partner who would often say to me, why are you trying to do more and be more all the time just by being yourself? You are affecting the lives of other people.
Yeah.
And I think it's also important to bear in mind that those of us who do orient toward shaping the society to fit us rather than the other way around, if we take it a step too far and think that everyone thinks the same way as us and everyone wants to live a world like us, and I'm thinking about this social innovation DAO kind of communities, to say, yeah, we have the solution to all the world's problems and we're basing it off what we want.
Yes.
We're designing for our own needs and assuming that everybody else wants to follow in such a way, that's inherently going to become dogmatic because it's the social innovators who maybe we're really tending to our own needs. But to create a measurable value where we feel it's creating use for the rest of the society, then I think to have such a method like Dragon Dreaming that understands the life cycle of a project and a project being a complex adaptive living system in itself, that it's really great to value those who are on the margins and just to survive, let alone thrive, need to have this kind of drive in influencing the world rather than so much being shaped by the world. Of course, we all do both to some degrees. But yeah, I feel that I can relate to people who carry your qualities because we're both maybe coming to it from this point of view. So there's a solidarity aspect in that. And also, I don't want to create designs under the illusion that this bubble is a metric of all of wider society.
Well, right? Creating the thing that you want to exist is great.
Yeah.
But believing that this is going to solve all of the world's problems is a Masonic complex.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is why getting to that moment of saying, hey, just by being who I am is enough.
Yeah.
That's, that is sustainability.
Yeah.
Rather than the kind of extractive, exploitative actions that we can take upon ourselves in order to translate our way of life to becoming accessible for more people, right?
Let me read this piece. This is by someone who, my friend Zach Mandeville, who was the person who introduced me to solarpunk. We can probably come back to that in a second.
Sure.
It's called Smash Mouth's White Magic. Somebody once told me the world was going to row me. I ain't the smartest tool in the shed. Are these lines from one of the most enduring songs of the 90s, or are they a sacred text from the occult teachings of Hermetic alchemy? The answer is both. Tonight, I'd like to talk to you about the hidden mystic significance of Smash Mouth. And I know I only have a few minutes of your time, but that's fine. This will be quick because that is obvious. The basic idea of Hermetic alchemy is that we're all made of two basic elements, light and sound. This is also the basic idea of every Smash Mouth song. Both tell us that human beings are simply light condensed into matter, and through ritual, we can change that light that radiates from us and thus change the world around us. But the first step is being made aware of that we are all light, or to paraphrase All Star, you will never shine if we first don't glow. Let's take a closer look at this song, as it is filled with occult references. The chorus is, hey now, you're an all-star. You are made of star. Mm. They make the alchemy even more explicit later when they say, all that glitters is gold. This is an important point. It is not just humans that are all-stars, it is everything. Everything is made of the same original element, but in different forms. The ground we walk on is no different from the sun that lights our way. It is all star stuff. As above, so below. Or to put it another way, we might as well be walking on the sun. Now, I'm like a lot of you in that I only know two Smash Mouth songs. So I bought their album to dig a little deeper, and I was blown away by what I found. First, notice the cover.
Okay, it's
you have
a
to
satellite.
Put that in the show notes, yeah. A neon-lit hotel floating off a rock in space. The idea of this is absurd. mod hotels and outer space don't go together. Yes, but 60s surf rock doesn't go with 90s SoCal rap rock. Smash Mouth's intent is to unify opposing elements. Their cover art, then, works as a psychedelic. It upsets the senses, and in your new vulnerable state, you can hear the message more clearly. And the message? It's hidden in the title of the album. Astro Lounge. Literally, relaxation in light. We've discussed the surface level of the album, but let's take a look at their track listings and deeper cuts. Track 1, All Star, Smart, start with the single. Track 2, Bam Fit Speaks. Track 3, The Emerald Tablet of Hermes Trismegistus. Track 4, To Lay With Endemy the Ethereal, the hand clap song. Track 5, Black Mass, Part 1, The Gathering. Track 6, Black Mass, Part 2, Renunciation. Track 7, Black Mass, Part 3, Initiation. Track 8, a really good cover of Can't Get Enough of You, Baby. Track 9, Black Mass, Finn, or Golden Unity. When you listen to the whole album, it all seems obvious. And in this light, we can now see the leader of Smash Mouth, Steve, as a modern mystic leader, wearing all the signs of the enlightened. He is rotund like the Buddha. The tips of his hair are frosted to form a halo around his head, the bleached ends looking like a flame that floats above him. He wears sunglasses all the time to show you that he does not need these eyes, for he does not see out of them. He sees out of the one that is located in the center of your forehead.
This is brilliant.
Unfortunately, while Smash Mouth is a send of good vibes and endless party, there is still an evil in this world. Mystery schools do not just house the holy. There is a dark evil in this world. Bands enriched by the occult arts whose only intent is to obfuscate and close us off from this holy clarity. Which brings me to why I'm really here. I want to talk to you about Third Eye Blind.
Oh no. It's the joke itself. Yeah. I will never be the same again. It's just the beginning. It's not the end. This reminds me of a truism that came out of a webinar or something hosted online, an online event, and we were talking about collective consciousness, and then there was a mishearing in the group, and then the truism came out that when we fail to understand each other directly, we create collective intelligence because of our interpretation about what was being said in that moment and the range of possibilities that were eligible in that moment and what we're reading onto that person actually widens the potential for this more sequential, you know, nailing down communication as though the things I was saying were going to be directly translated by you the way that I meant to say them.
Mm-hmm.
But it breaks all of that. It allows a bit of chaos to come in, and then there's a space for reinterpretation that is larger than the sum of the whole. The listener was not going to have that thought on their own. It was triggered by a otherwise insignificant phrase, right? And it was born out of mere context. Nobody controlled it. So there is this intelligent component to it. And I feel that the telling of a joke like that frames such a conversation because it breaks down the normative structure of the telling of a joke and allows you to enjoy the ride. As well as, I almost feel like he was daring himself to see what kind of wank he could pull out of comparing the most mundane thing with the most potentially holy. Do you follow?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's just like I've always like enjoyed laughing at religion and stuff like that. And this definitely fits in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I don't know this particular piece. I'm like, I'm not sure. It's like written as if it's like someone talking on a stage,
right? Yes.
I like read this from my friend's website, and I've have performed it for people like multiple times now. I've never actually I haven't performed it to Zach because he already knows it.
Sure.
Yeah, because it's normally I'm explaining this to... Oh, yeah, I should talk about Solarpunk. So Solarpunk, so Zach turned up on Scuttlebutt a few years ago and was like, hey, has anyone here heard of this idea, heard of this genre, Solarpunk? I think it's really interesting.
And he found it off of Tumblr, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I like clicked through, and Solarpunk is like this emerging like science fiction genre that is about it's like, you know, like punk as the suffix was like there was cyberpunk,
yes,
and then there was steampunk, and then people made a whole bunch of different punks.
C-punk.
Yeah, just anything dash punk.
Right.
And then someone was like, well, what about solar panels? What about solar punk? And
which is super wholesome when you think about the two guys.
That's exactly what it was. Yeah. It was like cyberpunk is this dark,
oxymoronic,
dark, scary thing.
Sure.
Solar punk was just like this fantasy. Well, what if like Victorian, what if like colonialism just continued indefinitely and we didn't discover any of the problems with it? And then, but solar punk is like, what happens if it's a future society where we live in harmony with nature, but we're still high tech.
Right.
It's it's an optimistic future that doesn't involve just uploading our minds to the cloud.
Yeah, we maintain our humanity in this scenario. Which the punk is also a symbol of that humanity somehow, because I feel that in this mythopoetic things of the human sinner and like we get drawn down into the material world through our imperfections.
Yes.
There is this element of punk that says like, I'm the goat, I'm going my own way. And that spark of will almost fundamentally creates what we think of as humanity.
Yeah. In fact, I learned recently that when the dinosaurs were extincted by this meteorite, all of the primary carnivores and predators, all the things that ate plants directly they all died out. And the things that survived were the animals that ate trash.
Oh, yeah.
The ones that just ate stuff, the scavengers and the things that will just... Like the things
it's
that
highly adaptable. Ready-ready.
Yes, you the know, punks.
Being so fussy.
The punk animals. Those were the things that survived. So all life that has survived that on Earth is like descended from these like bottom feeding scavengers.
That's why punk is so sexy.
Yeah.
And all the true punks are pointing finger at the hoax punks, like, you don't really know how to be punk. And all the burners are pointing at all the Instagram influencers and going, you don't really know how to survive in the desert.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a valuable aspect of society.
That's right. Yeah.
So how does the concept of solar punk, and maybe just to close this down a little bit, to speak of being a good traveler, how does that build into your dreams for the next 5 years?
Well, solarpunk became this like catch-all phrase, this like all-encompassing umbrella that was like everyone I knew that had some kind of like working to some kind of optimistic vision of the future. They all fit under this and be like, you're just a solarpunk. You just didn't know. There just wasn't a word for what this was. But now there is.
Yeah.
Solarpunk.
Okay.
You're a solarpunk.
Yeah.
And so I started just telling everyone I met about solarpunk.
Yeah.
And nearly everyone hadn't heard of it before.
Mm.
But now I've met a couple of people who independently knew about solarpunk and had come up with the same interpretation.
Mm.
So it's just like, this is like a new powerful meme that I think is like a future we can, This is the answer we've been looking for.
Wow. Yeah. The one answer.
Well, I mean, in this stage in the story.
To go on. This is like a national anthem of a society that hasn't been born yet.
This is like, it's like a positive direction that you can start like acting on just by imagining what this future world looks like and then starting to act on that in a little way. even if you're just like...
What are some more of the values of that, aside from being a trash lord?
I mean, like, the beautiful thing about it is that it's sufficiently vague that you can interpret it any way you like.
So that permits a certain level of autonomy.
But it's just like, it's high tech and it's green.
Yep.
Go. Renewable. Go nuts. Yeah. It's like, but it's so punk is also inherently like DIY and stuff. So just start messing around with like growing things and solar panels, and I'm sure you'll come up with something good. And you'll inspire other people with your positive vision of the future rather than this really depressing one. Like, climate change is really kind of bleak.
It's a bit confronting.
And yeah, and so nobody wants to think about... Most people really don't want to think about bleak, disturbing things. They'd rather just do something else. But solarpunk actually has a positive vision.
Yeah.
So...
Wow, beautiful.
It's good to think about. It's enjoyable to imagine this positive future.
And we're still at least a couple hundred thousand years away from the moment that we do lose the sun as well. So perhaps it's actually billions.
The sun is forecast to expand massively. It'll get cooler, but it'll get much massively bigger. And I can't remember if it's going to swallow the Earth or if it's just going to swallow like Mercury and Venus, but...
Do you think we'll have some good use cases of DAOs by then?
Well, that
might
is,
have a solar DAO.
That is like several billion years in the future, and there's this like that is sufficiently far enough away that we don't need to worry about that. But so there's this other thing called the Long Now Foundation. Have you heard of this?
No.
So they're a thing where they were like, we should be thinking about the future in much, much broader terms. Like, it's a struggle to even find people that are thinking like 100 years in the future, but they're like,
okay, but do you not think that some indigenous societies who practice the seven generation principle nailed it down to seven generations for a reason? Like, is there not some wisdom toward practicing not getting too far ahead of yourself?
This is the first time I've heard of the seven generations principle.
Welcome.
What's that? That's ballpark 200 years.
I did work it out once, but like you're it's the one like with the numbers. I'm the one with the colours.
Oh, it's like if it's 25 years a generation, then that's
175.
Mm-hmm. Let me finish this thought and then we'll come back to that because that is very interesting. So the Long Now Foundation, they're like, we should think about things like 10,000 years in the future, which is like the length of human civilization that we know it.
Well,
we should just be like, how we've survived 10,000 years, how are we going to survive the next 10,000 years?
It sounds very arrogant to me to even put that forward. I mean, do you think there's the possibility to simulate that much speculation?
No, but what could you really say will be happening in 10,000 years? But you could say I think they mostly act to point out the absurdity that we don't even imagine, like, what would it be like in another 10,000 years?
Okay.
Yes, like, could we, just the fact that we can't imagine it.
Well, you know, it's just great for them to introduce some conversation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'd go through the entire bureaucratic procedure of setting up a foundation just to create a discourse around
They also built a clock.
Oh, nice.
They built a physical clock that was designed to continue running for 10,000 years.
Wow.
It's powered by the temperature difference between night and day.
Oh my god.
And it's in it's also kind of like a temple that's like carved into a mountain.
Whoa.
of solid stone in Nevada somewhere. On land that belongs to Jeff Bezos.
What? And you say belongs to, like,
well, in the currently this is a piece of paper that says Jeff Bezos on that land. But anyway,
intense.
You know, that's the Long Now Foundation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay,
we're talking about the Seven Generations Principle, which is a kind of segued from the stolen land concept. There are societies from the Americas in the north part of that wide continent who would practice putting a seven generations fire when the elders would gather to make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be, I mean, have you ever practiced having a conversation with people where you don't directly address each other, but everybody speaks to the fire. It becomes this neutral place for you to really open up and be transparent about your own interpretation, about what's going on with you, without having this kind of direct two egos meeting.
I've definitely had interesting conversations around fires.
Yeah, they tend to evoke a certain thing about us. We evolved around fireplaces, mm-hmm. and I think I shared this with you, but for the benefit of the listeners, there's an anthropological theory that's somewhat recent that says we didn't actually go from being apes toward being apes with a spoken word, but mm-hmm. first we learned to sing.
Yeah.
Which makes sense because we would be probably imitating the sounds of our natural world and then using that to communicate. And so what would happen once we discovered fire was at the end of the day, we would meet around the fire in a circle and sing as a form of communication, and language evolved from there. So the fire is quite central toward the commons of humanity and, mm-hmm. and maybe just culture. So this is a principle of making decisions around fire that represents 7 generations from now. So these choices have that accountability of the future prospect. And I would love to take that in many directions. However, I don't want to pick one now. I want to get this to a safe landing. and I feel that we could manifest another moment for round two if that's what, you know, needs to happen.
Yeah.
Whether in New Zealand or not. But in the meantime, I look forward to the next... Well, do we have anything on the cards to work on next at the time of this recording? I sought your help in starting to learn how to sail.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting onto some floating islands. We talk about Borderland and the Baltic next year. And in Stockholm, there's this port that would be a wonderful connection place now that Blivanda is creating a cultural square. And I spoke to you about the idea of creating a cooperative DAO, or distributed cooperative organization that managed a kind of local food economy around this cafe.
Is there a dragon dreaming version of action points?
Ah, action points. I guess that would be the tasks that you put in the Karabeard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Karabeard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Karabeard. But I still use multiple tools that aren't part of the Dragon Dreaming framework.
They're it just sounds
not
like
necessarily
more fun.
One size fits all.
The Dragon Dreaming just sounds like a lot more fun.
It is. There's a truism from Dragon Dreaming. If it's not playful, it's not sustainable. So in writing a to-do list, I've also learned about writing it in such a way to yourself that you would enjoy reading it. And I've been experimenting with, instead of writing a task like put together a process design for facilitating this in my group, I would say the group might really appreciate if you put consideration, or the group could benefit from your unique insight of process. You know, just putting it in a different way that I can leave hints for myself that make the task appear more attractive. So why don't we tune in to the silence between us here and now and consider what might be a fun wish to sow into the future. And then in Dragon Dreaming, when you do a dream circle, you say, what happened that made it, like, investing your energy in the project 100% worth it? What happened that made that worth your energy? And then you frame it in the past tense and speak from the I. So I could say, I loved sailing over to one of New Zealand's weird islands with you when I was there this summer. And now I've cast a seed into the future. Would you like to plant one?
I loved having the first opportunity to be the senior shaman.
Yes.
Teaching the pupil shaman. Someone didn't even realize they were shaman yet.
Wow. I'm just going to have to let that one sink in.
Mm-hmm.
But I like your definition, so I'll go on that. Appreciate being a junior fringe. Thank you, Dominic, for recording with
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and props to our friend whose name I don't know for lending the technological capacity to make this happen. Shout out to you. All right, checking out. Kakiteano. Doop 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 do